You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel. You're a monster, Mr. Grinch. Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul.
Everybody, welcome to Film Wax Radio, episode number 452. Happy holidays to you and all your loved ones. This show is two conversations, the first with Jacob Kornbluth, who directed a new documentary. It's currently streaming on Netflix. It's called Saving Capitalism, and it is about Robert Reich and the way Robert Reich wants to connect to American people crossing all divides, whether political or otherwise, to have frank conversations about the economy today. The film is very accessible. It's a lot of fun. I got on Skype with Jacob the other day, and you're about to hear that conversation. His brother, Josh Kornbluth, was on the show last year, in fact, with a film that the two collaborated on. I'm just really delighted to bring on Jacob now as well, who's a great filmmaker. And then after that, we're going to have on the editor of I, Tanya, Tatiana Riegel, this Craig Gillespie's film, the dark comedy, which is currently in theaters and sweeping up nominations and awards recently and probably going forward as well. It's a terrific film if you have not had a chance, starring Margot Robbie and Allison Janney and a whole terrific cast. So I highly recommend it. I love that film. So first up here is going to be my conversation with Jacob Kornbluth on Film Wax Radio.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard.
Answer that guy's question.
And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules.
We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind.
And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Reich, former labor secretary under President Clinton.
I wanted to go to places where I could actually interact.
I really want to talk to people about their lives.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Money, where have you gone to? Money.
As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power.
People don't trust that our society is working for most people.
Got to pay my bills, got to pay my rent. I'm hungry and tired, but my money's all spent.
Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, doing really well.
Wait, one second. A little sip of gin. It's late afternoon here. It's supposed to...
No apology necessary. Any time of day is a good time to hit the sauce.
Did you? I believe I had your brother on my podcast.
Was it him?
It was
I
him.
Remember it happening for around the Woodstock
Texas.
Film Festival, right?
Yeah, but it was him because I've seen Josh in a play, you know, one of his one-man shows years and years ago.
Okay.
And I remembered him. That's how, you know, great a show it was. I saw him and I said, oh, yeah, sure. And so I hadn't even seen Love and Taxes yet, but it was the only time I could talk to him. So I ended up doing a podcast based on just chatting. It was, you know, I insist on seeing a film before I talk to somebody, you know. You'd think that would be the, you know, typical way to go.
Yeah, no, well, I got to say, I will always have a place in my heart for that movie. I mean, it's just, it was so fun and crazy as a creative process in terms of, you know, making something that
sure.
It's almost like it defied all the kind of basic rules of how to make a movie and be successful in the industry these days. I mean, what I loved best about it was the spirit we made it with sort of, I felt like, came through in the finished film in a way. You know, it had like a real kind of authenticity to it that I don't see often, you know, mm-hmm. in film. So I'm incredibly proud of it. I just wish for the life of me I could have got more people to go see it, you know. It's just one of those things. When you make a movie about taxes with a bald-headed, you know, kind of Ben Franklin look-alike Jewish guy as the love interest.
And that was, of course, the play itself.
It didn't have to work commercially, but...
No, I understand the frustration. That was the one I saw him do, of course, was the Benjamin Franklin piece. So you're talking about like 20 years ago, something like maybe close to 20 years ago is when I saw him on, I forget where, in New York City, you know.
Where are you based out of?
I'm in New York. I'm currently on the Upper West Side, but don't tell anyone. Everyone thinks
it's a secret.
It is a secret. Nobody knows. I usually am in Brooklyn, but my circumstances have taken me to the upper West Side. But it's very nice. I really like it. So that's where I am. This means you've actually worked on three films with Robert Reich.
Well, I've made two feature films with him. I made Inequality for All, a documentary that Radius, the Weinstein Company, released in 2013. Mm-hmm. And then I started a nonprofit with them called Inequality Media that has produced something like 120 videos the last few years and that have been seen, you know, pushing 300 million times now. So
it's crazy. Those are by and large just out there on the YouTubes.
Yeah. They're on Facebook and all across social media. And they've really, I think, been an interesting contribution to the kind of political conversation. But as a filmmaker, they've also been an invaluable kind of dialogue with audience. You can see kind of what people are interested in by what they watch in these kind of short videos. And that's kind of helped guide why I wanted to make Saving Capitalism and also why I wanted to make Inequality for All a few years before that. It felt like when we made Inequality for All that this story of widening economic inequality was, I felt like it was the story of my life, so it was kind of a personal story in one way for me, but also it was pretty clear that a lot of people wanted to know what had happened for the economic crisis of 2008. They wanted some big picture context to it, and the story of widening economic inequality felt like it was valuable in that conversation, but it felt like as we were making the videos, the story of that the economy isn't like the weather, that it doesn't just happen to you, that there's a way we can shape the rules of the economic system that either work for more people or that benefit a small group of rich people, felt like a piece of the story that we hadn't been able to tell as well in Inequality for All. There was a way to watch that film where you might not know that this wasn't inevitable, that this widening economic inequality didn't have to happen, but that power actually shapes the rules of the game and that this is a story of people shaping a system that either works for people or doesn't. And that felt like something new to talk about. And when we started making Saving Capitalism, it felt like that this was going to remake the whole political landscape from something that was Democratic and Republican to something that was more about whether or not you were in the establishment or in the anti-establishment, or whether the economy was working for you if you're in the top 10% of the economic distribution or the 90% of us who it isn't working for.
Yeah,
so
you shifted the conversation from politics to class, or there may have been a couple of different levels to it, but one was definitely class because, you know, everybody's hurting. We can all relate on that level, if not politically. But I wanted to ask you first, before we get too much further into the film, just to backtrack for a second about the videos. Describe a lot of the videos. Are these conversations with average folks? What are the videos that you guys have produced in Inequality Media? I'm just trying to figure out something in my head.
Well, Inequality Media was formed to kind of continue to engage the dialogue about widening economic inequality and its consequences to our economy and our democracy on social media. So you make a feature film and a certain amount of people watch the film, but the people, you always hear this when you make a documentary about political subject, people say something like, well, it's great that you're talking to us, but what about the people who really need to hear it? How are they going to get this message? And so those folks are generally speaking on Facebook and YouTube and social media sites like that. And what if we made videos for them that sort of reinforce the themes of the bigger films that we're making?
Mm-hmm.
What these turned out to be is Robert Reich in front of a whiteboard, largely drawing out, scribbling, if you will, some notes about how it all works on a whiteboard, explaining complex economic issues in a way that are simple and accessible for people to understand. And those videos are released on Robert Reich Facebook page, and they're released on YouTube and Twitter. And, you know, a fair amount of people have found the message that way, or, you know, sort of plugged in that way, and then gone back and found, say, Inequality for All, or a fair amount of people started out as Facebook fans that are now finding Saving Capitalism. So
it's a helpful component in building an audience for your feature films.
Absolutely. It seems to be inseparable.
Yeah.
You know, that it seems like one big story.
Right.
Exactly.
Oh, I see. So you're creating, you know, for lack of another term, content, which is kind of circularly helping people figure it out. And one thing I'd like to say, you know, that affected me from the documentary, and again, it's called Saving Capitalism, is that former, you know, labor secretary under Clinton and like an academic, you know, you'd think if somebody's in politics, academia, publishing, that this guy might be kind of a nerd, kind of like a bit removed. But I haven't seen anybody as genuinely interested in connecting about his passions with just regular people. You don't see that very frequently on that level, and such a commitment to it. But when he says that, talk to people who aren't in your bubble, you know, those are the kinds of, he understands the bigger picture. We're not going to accomplish anything as a citizenry without all getting together.
Yeah, no, firstly, you know, I've often said that if he didn't exist, I would have to invent him. You know, he's an incredibly credible economic, you know, kind of wonk, if you will,
who knows his
stuff economically. But his relatability, his sense to connect on a human level, he's 4 feet 11. He's extraordinarily notable as a visual, as a guy on camera in that way. But he's such a powerful presence, and he's so human that it makes him sort of this interesting mix of, if you will, like easy to watch on camera or camera ready, but also wonky in a good way. And it's very hard to find somebody who can communicate these big ideas in a way that doesn't feel like just a bunch of charts and facts and figures, but feels like it relates to your life. And he has a very unique talent and ability to do that. And in both films, in Inequality for All and in Saving Capitalism, the challenge as a filmmaker is to line up something that you might call like a regular personal story, the story that you track in a film about somebody who goes through a change over the course of, you know, the 90 minutes or whatever you're watching, with this kind of really big picture macroeconomic story. And in Inequality for All and in Saving Capitalism both, we tried to do that in terms of tracking a journey in Robert Reich's personal life that mirrors this bigger story. In this case, it was that in 2017, it's 50 years that he spent in the political game. He started in 1967 and, you know, came up to today. And can you imagine if you were engaged in politics for that time, fighting against economic inequality and for the betterment of regular people? Can you imagine how much worse it's gotten for people over that time? And if you've been saying the same thing for that time and essentially no one's been listening to you for that period, and you find yourself staring down at Donald Trump presidency, how you would feel. So that was the story you're tracking on a personal level, is how he's tracked these journeys, or how's he tracked the changes in the economy over this time as an advocate, but also how difficult that must have been as a guy to sort of watch those things unfold. And Saving Capitalism tries to do both, you know, in kind of one package.
Well, people can catch it on Netflix right now if they're interested. It's been on Netflix for about 2 or 3 weeks now, right?
Yeah, a few weeks. And we've gotten, you know, really good, you know, kind of feedback from Netflix and from audiences. I had the opportunity last week in Washington, D.C. to show the film at the National Press Club, and Bernie Sanders introduced it. That was a kind of personal highlight moment. But, you know, there's this sense also, which I'm quite proud of with both films, that they're good, you know, fun movies to watch, if you will, even though they're about dark topics. They're not, it doesn't totally feel like taking your medicine. It feels like you learn something nourishing, but you also can have a good time watching a decent film that's, you know, somebody spent some, a lot of time and effort to put together in a kind of cohesive, entertaining way.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a far stretch for you to produce a film with him next, like kind of a dance exercise, dance video, because he's got moves. The guy's
absolutely
got moves.
I think he danced pretty well too, right?
Yeah, who knew this guy had moves? I mean, you know, I'm joking, during the end credit, he's breaking into a dance, but he's actually has rhythm, and it's he's obviously, you know, he seems to have fun. And he says it's important not to forget to have fun, because, you know, we can get really depressed and dismayed by the news, you know, that we're confronted with all the time. And that news may include just our bills, our paychecks, etc. So he has a good point.
Well, it's one of the amazing things about working with him is he is consistently optimistic. And, you know, for any of us who are engaged in the political fight that is happening right now, the sense of how you don't get depressed, how you don't give in to cynicism, how you don't, you know, sort of give up is a big challenge. Mm-hmm. And I've really learned something from him in that respect. I mean, somehow, I think genuinely, he stays positive despite all the things he's been through. And that spirit sort of is, you know, in one way, you know, he says sometimes, and I think he's being serious when he says, how do you stay positive? And there's several answers, but one of them is he doesn't like the alternative. And I think if you stop being positive, if you stop having a good time, if you get, you know, too bummed out, on a personal level, it's tough, but also you cede the political fight to the moneyed interests that are trying to take over our system, and we lose. So it's important.
I think it helps too when you're out there and you're actually meeting people and you're going on lecture tours, book tours. You know, it gives you an opportunity to meet everyone. I mean, I would feel that would put me in a better mood, you know, even though there are a lot of harder stories to hear as well as positive stories. But just being engaged in a constant basis and also being able to give positive context, positive side to things, to help people figure out ways that they can help, that must feel over time like a kind of a salve, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, like you're doing something. Yeah, you feel like you're out there doing something. You're absolutely right. I mean, I have to say, just for me personally, getting to travel around with him and talk to people who were Republicans and talk to people who were, you know, liberals who think that, in, you know, we should trash capitalism and there's no need to save it. So people who were angry with him on both sides did feel invigorating. It felt positive. It felt like we were having a dialogue, even if it didn't feel like it was always going, you know, somewhere. You don't resolve it, but you're engaged. And we started making this film, Adam, in 2015, when the leading candidates for office were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. It looked like we were looking at some dynastic political discussion, which, you know, turned into Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders later. But we didn't actually know that was happening when we were out there. And we got to see that develop in real people, like sort of really considering that there's a farmer we talked to in the film who's deciding between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And we saw people struggling with these issues before they had sort of hit the national, you know, political landscape. That was incredibly gratifying. And it was also, once we saw that Trump was going to win, the idea of having a film that I could work on that would sort of, you know, channel my energies into, you know, sort of trying to reckon with how personally devastated I was by the results and also how chaotic the political landscape felt. To have a film to work on was just a real, you know, it felt like a balm too, like a real salve to help deal with it.
Yeah, in fact, I think there was a speech in your documentary, which is again called Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Kornbluth. There was a speech, Robert Reich, he makes a speech, I think it's taken from a while back, you know what it is? It's when he leaves the Clinton White House. He steps down from his role as labor secretary, and he makes in the speech a couple of comments which seem almost prescient to the birth of how Trump could come to be as, you know, the president, in terms of where we were headed as a country, as an economy. And then another thing that he said during the film in contemporary time is that he said that he felt that he had not done enough, and that was obviously something weighing on him.
No, it's the speech is from 1997, and he talks about how America was becoming a two-tiered society, and the consequences to this weren't just economic, but it's the resentment and the hatred that is building, and this is 97 again, will eventually turn us to look for scapegoats and, you know, upend our political process. I mean, that's in 1997.
And, 20 years ago.
You know, it's funny because he had forgotten about that speech when we started making the film. And when we started putting this together, we uncovered it and we showed it to him. And I think it was a little bit jarring for him, you know, to see.
Wow, I'm really smart.
Well, I don't know if he had that feeling as much as, oh my God, I think it was like a little bit of sadness in there. You know, it was like, I've been thinking about this stuff and talking about it for so long. And you know, the second point you made, and we're in sort of, you know, we're in deeper shit, as he says. You know, I don't know if you can say that here on podcast radios, radio programs, but, you know, it's both, you know, I guess some validation to say that he talked about it before, but it's also a little bit of,
well, it might remind him, because he did say it, and he, on some level, he wasn't quite tuned. Maybe he wasn't tuned in enough to his own predictions, that if he had been, he might have done more at the time to warn people in a much more aggressive way. And maybe he feels like he didn't do that, and he failed on some level, which is, of course, hindsight. You know, it's he's still done a tremendous amount, more than most people. And he, as you say, he's now in his 70s. Seems like he has a lot of energy. It's for somebody his
more
age.
More than people,
you know,
half his age, I can attest.
He seems to have a lot of enthusiasm, and it makes for a far more entertaining documentary than, again, you may assume by the title. Don't let that turn you away. You should check it out. And it's at a very brisk hour and 7-8 minutes, the film. I mean,
yeah, it's 73 minutes total, and I think some of that is dancing. So
yeah, that's right. You don't want to miss that. So now to get to other things, so you had some thoughts on my campaign. Thank you, by the way, Jake, for supporting the campaign, by the way.
Well, just that it's so cool that you made it. What an impressive accomplishment. I think you had a lofty goal. And, you know, I'll say this as somebody who was on the other end, as who was able to make a very modest contribution to it. But you don't realize that, you know, as an individual who doesn't have a ton of resources to give to others, that it makes a difference. You know, you sort of feel like, you know, maybe it's not that big of a deal. And then, you know, I was particularly moved, and this is genuine, by the note that you said maybe on a Facebook video or something, but you said the small donations from people were really what put me over the top, you know? Maybe it's a metaphor to pull back to the saving capitalism discussion. You know, there's this feeling that, you know, nothing I can do can make a difference, but you do your little piece, you try your best, you know, you try to help it. You know, it was an important thing for me, and I felt really good about being able to support your drive. I was really happy when you reached it, and I didn't think that my little bit could do any good, but, you know, it turns out that there were others just like me who were given a little bit, and that was all helpful.
It's no joke. I mean, so many people were apologizing for giving, and I understand, you know, you feel self-conscious because you're on some level, you want to give more, and also you're advertising, oh, by the way, I don't have any money. So, but that, you know, look, everybody is in the same boat. Again, this is funny because it's so meta as part of saving capitalism and inequality for all that, you know, we're all suffering or working really hard against a wave. We're working under a great challenge to get through, you know, life economically speaking. And so, you know, I you know, one thing people should know is you're one of many, you know, so everybody was saying this and I was constantly, after a while, I was like, wow, I really need to let people know, you know, it is the collection. If I made a pie chart, I'm sure it's the biggest part of the pie where these modest, as you use the term modest, contributions all added up, they definitely make of the larger portion, the largest portion of the campaign. Anyhow, so it was quite a, it was just a very educational experience, and it definitely has blown me away in many ways. You know, it's just I wouldn't necessarily want to go through it anytime soon again, but anyway, so I just wanted to we can end things. I think I mentioned it enough times, but one more time won't hurt. Saving Capitalism is currently available for subscribers of Netflix.
Well, Adam, I don't know what else you'd like to talk about, but I just want to say congrats on the Kickstarter campaign coming through, and thank you for talking to us about Love and Taxes. That was meaningful to me as a filmmaker, but also to my brother I know, and I'm glad I get a chance to talk with you in person about this one. So,
Same here. And if you know, if we find each other in one of our cities, we'll get together for a drink or something, or coffee or something.
I love both. So whichever you choose, whichever you prefer.
Okay.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you so much. Let me know if you need anything else.
Okay. Too. Will do. All right. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active. Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
It was a delight to talk to Tatiana Riegel. She collaborated with the director, Craig Gillespie, a number of times, including on Lars and the Real Girl. And they're back with a new film. It's called I, Tanya. I'm sure you've seen it and heard about it. It's a wonderful satirical look at the whole story about Tanya Harding and how she became infamous in the media, from going from an Olympic star to a punchline. But here, this humanizes Tanya Harding. And in the process, it's a very creates a very, very entertaining film. And one of the key components of the success of the film is the editing, as well as the relationship between Tatiana Riegel, the editor, and the filmmaker. And so I'm really glad to bring her on to the podcast right now. Go check out I, Tanya when you get a chance.
The haters always say, Tanya, tell the truth. There's no such thing as truth. Everyone has their own truth. I was the best figure skater in the world at one point in time.
You call that a clean skate? Stop talking to her. That girl is your enemy.
Waiting for the break of day.
Jeff was my first date ever. And my mom came.
You need to see a wholesome American family.
I don't have a wholesome American family.
Nothing's ever your fault. I was embarrassed for you.
My entire life, I've been told I wouldn't amount to anything. And you know what? Maybe I would.
I'm fine, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Good.
Where are you?
Los Angeles, where are you?
Manhattan.
Manhattan. I was there working on this movie for 6 months.
Editing it?
Yeah. Yeah, we did all the posts in New York, yeah.
Okay.
At Harbor Post on Varick and King.
Oh, yes. I've heard of it. Well, you're jumping right into things. I haven't even had a time to acclimate.
I'm sorry. I just got excited by the Manhattan of it all.
No, I know, too. And what area are you in Los Angeles?
I'm up in the hills here.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. No, I live up in the hills, which is lovely. I'm very fortunate, particularly at this time of year, because our skies, with the exception of the fires, are really lovely.
Yeah, how far is that?
There was one about 8 miles that way, the Bel Air one.
Okay.
The rest are pretty far away.
Yeah.
And the Bel Air one was far away, too, but there was a lot of smoke and ash and smell.
Yeah, and people are breathing that in, right? So
fortunately not here.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, it's really nice to for this connection and for this opportunity. I am a big fan of iTanya.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. So you've worked with, I know, Craig Gillespie, the director, a bunch of times, correct? You have a long ongoing...
Yeah, I've worked with him for about 10 years. This is our fifth feature, and we did a pilot together as well.
A pilot?
Yeah, The United States of Tara.
Oh!
Yeah.
Yeah, the Australian actress.
Yes, with Toni Collette.
Toni Collette.
That
Australian actress that, you know.
There's so few as Australian actresses. It's hard to pick one out, yeah.
We are so enamored with either the Australian, because it seems especially the actresses, the female actors, like whether they're British or Australian, even New Zealand, you know, we love them. And they do darn good American accents.
Well, They're really good. I don't know if it's training or just their general sensibility, but yes, it's true. Australians, New Zealand, British, they're spectacular group of actors.
Yeah. Margot Robbie, where's she from?
Yeah.
Where's she from? Australian. Once again, so you can't get away from these Australians.
I cannot get away from them.
Well, I went to a screening of iTanya. And, you know, I had heard such positive things about it anyway. So going into it, I was ready to have a good time. And, you know, it didn't disappoint, of course. And then I was just so mesmerized by the performances, not only Margot, but also I just thought Allison Janney was, like, every time you think she's, you know, going to deliver a performance that's going to top, you know, her, she comes back with another one.
Yeah.
You know, like this performance, and this is astounding.
She's amazing. She's a phenomenal actress. She's fantastic in this role. It was written for her. She and the writer
are
very good friends.
Oh, is that right?
And have been friends for years and years. I think they went to a theater class together many years ago. And from what I understand, he's actually written many roles for her. That she was then not cast in. So this time he put it in his requirements when he sold the script, because he wrote it on spec, that Allison play this part. And as the producers have told me, and also the director, they were thrilled with that because she's a phenomenal actress. This is actually the third film I've done with her also.
Really?
And every time I see she's in the cast of something that I work on, I get very excited because she's amazing. But anyway, so she was one of the first people attached to the film. Brian Unkles got a hold of it, and that's when Margot and Tom got involved. And then, of course, Margot, was attached to act in it as well, but she produces the film. And that's how they all got involved, and then they found Craig, and then Craig dragged me along for the ride.
I see. So this was kind of brought to, I don't know how, but I guess this is not unusual where they may be thinking of a number of different directors, and then it was a project that was in development, and it was brought to the team. Right. Yeah. But here's the thing. So there's a number of, it's not unusual for there to be a director editor relationship that goes through many films. Obviously, another case would be Martin Scorsese and Thelma Schumacher. That's a very well-known example. But there are many, right? So you have that with Craig, it seems like.
I do, and I love it, and I consider myself extraordinarily fortunate. I worked for many years as an assistant to Sally Menke, who was Quentin Tarantino's editor.
Oh, yeah.
I worked for her for about 7 years. And on three of Quentin's films and on a number of other ones. And that was always a relationship that I saw and admired very greatly and hoped for one day in my own career, as obviously the Martin-Thelma relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That does happen with editors and directors. And I think it's ideal. First of all, it's a luxury because you have a shorthand and ability to communicate with each other, and an ease and a security also, frankly, that you're understanding what they want. You understand how to give it to them. in often very stressful situations and stuff. So it's a real luxury to have that shorthand. And the first job that I got with Craig was on Lars and the Real Girl.
Great film.
And we just hit it off right away, and I just feel really fortunate to have been able to stay in sync with him, and not to mention be fortunate enough that he keeps calling me back.
And that you guys are getting such great projects.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. We've done a great variety of projects, which I like, different genres, which always keeps the job terribly interesting. But oddly, we've sort of wrapped around back to the Lars odd tone kind of thing, which I think really is his wheelhouse, and mine also. It's frankly the sort of films that I like, that I go to see on my own, are these things that are sort of a tricky tone.
Right.
And he's just great at it.
Yeah, there aren't that many filmmakers who can accomplish quite that tone and be so good at it. Like you're describing, some might call it a dark comedy or satire. It's, you know, it's something the typical American audience is, you know, not always the most comfortable with. Other, like the British do it really well. I think there's a lot of great examples, of course, here in the States as well. And I think there's obviously I, Tonya has really been embraced. And it's going to do real well as far as award season goes. Has there been already some? There's been some nominations, I assume.
There have. In fact, there were just two this morning. The SAG Awards, Margot right. and Allison got nominated. A few days ago, the Golden Globe nominations for Best Picture, Best Comedy Picture, and Allison and Margot again, which is fantastic. Also, Allison, the Independent Spirit Awards. Allison, Margot, and I got nominated as well for
Congratulations.
Best Editing, which was really, really a tremendous honor and unexpected and really fun because I hear it's a great party.
I don't know. I used to vote, but I got a little lazy about it. But I had voted in the spirits for many years.
That's great. Yeah.
I think I would vote for yours this time.
Well, that's very sweet of you. Thank you.
Well, I should follow through. So what is the nature? I know that sometimes some editors are actually even on the set because they're able to help to structure this film, or kind of even assemble it at times while you're going. I guess it depends on a number of factors like your schedule, the time frame of the picture, et cetera.
Yeah.
How involved are you during production? Or have you developed go ahead.
Well, I obviously start when they start shooting, sometimes before they start shooting, depending on the film. If it's a big visual effects film or something like that, I'll start earlier doing pre-vis and, working with all of that prep stuff. On this, I started basically more or less the day they started shooting. They shot in Atlanta, and I actually stayed in Los Angeles. Part of that was just budgetary. You know, it's expensive to drag people around. The other part of that was that I knew we were going to be doing all of post in New York. So I frankly wanted to be home, and I had the luxury to have such a good communication with Craig that was fine. So what I did was I started assembling scenes right away, and I send them to him. So he gets things, you know, sometimes every day, sometimes every couple of days, so he can see everything that he's shooting, rough assemblies of them, sometimes better than others, but so that he can make sure that obviously that he's getting the coverage that he wants, that he's getting the performances and the tone that he wants, and that we can start our dialogue about what's going to happen in the future and if anything else needs to be picked up or whatever. So I was here in LA. I generally try, honestly, not to go to the set very much.
Mm-hmm.
I have a theory, for me it works very well. I feel like the editor is really sort of the only audience involved with the movie. In other words, I'm not there for all of development and all of the script rewrites and casting and location scouting and all of the compromises and changes and stuff that happen as this thing is being developed. And I don't even want to be there on the set because I don't want to know what it took to get that shot, or what the mood of the set was or whatever. I want to know what it's like when I watch it on my monitor as an audience would watch it. If I understand, if I believe the performances, if I understand what's going on, if I get the geography, all of those things. And I think that I am the only person involved with the film that's an audience member, and I try to hold on to that as long as I possibly can. So if a shot comes in and it took them half the day to set it up and get this really spectacular, beautiful, whatever, and I'm like, you know, that should be cut in half. Mm-hmm. I don't have any qualms about doing that because, you know, that's where it'll end up anyway.
It sounds like there's, I mean, again, I'm just guessing here based on clues, but it sounds like maybe that Craig and his team are really organized and prepared going into production.
Extraordinarily organized. That's one of the most wonderful things about working with Craig. He's got years and years of experience. First of all, he's done now 5 features, but beyond that, he's a commercial director, and he's directed, you know, I would venture to say hundreds of commercials, and he's been doing it for, you know, 30 years or something. And he, in order to do that, you have to be extraordinarily ready for anything. So he knows exactly what he wants to do. He's extremely flexible, and on the day, those things change. If actors want to bring something or if they want to try something, but he always knows what he's going for at that moment. And I think it really helps tonally with a film that's so difficult to have something to follow and to be prepared for something. With this particular film, you know, for example, there's some pretty serious stuff that takes place. There's domestic violence and abuse, and it's pretty powerful and disturbing stuff. And he didn't want to sugarcoat any of that. And so he had to really plan that, what that was going to be, mixed with the comedy in order, I think, to make it sort of tolerable. But he had to be ready for that sort of stuff to take place and to be prepared. The other part of that is that it was 260 some scenes in 31 days, just a Herculean feat to get that done, with all kinds of stuff, costume changes, wig changes, you know, people skating, stunts, all of this sort of stuff. And they got it all done, which is amazing.
How many scenes set up?
I think it's like 265, approximately, something like that.
That's not setups, I'm sorry. Those are scenes. How does that, as opposed to some other film, how does that affect your job? I mean,
well, it affects my job in that with this particular film, it was interesting because it's a lot of, you sort of come into, by nature of it, and with the interviews and stuff like that, you're sort of dropping into moments and leaving moments, as opposed to sort of a more flowing, linear progression of storytelling. We're kind of bopping all around in time and and so that's always a challenge, to make sure that that all makes sense and that something's not dragging or becoming redundant or, you know, just out of place. So, you know, there are a few things that get moved around or deleted. We lost some scenes. So we lost some pretty terrific scenes, actually.
I bet.
But, but for the sake of the overall film. And that becomes then the process as the first cut is together. You know, the first assembly is the cut of the script, you know. I mean, that's just what that is. And then you start to really get in and manipulate and make the movie and expand and contract time and make sure that you are always moving forward and bringing the audience along.
Is that typical, just like a convention that most editors?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, often they call the first, I call it the first assembly. A lot of people call it the editor's cut. I actually really don't like that because that's not my cut. There are a lot of times I can see that scene is not going to make it, or it's in the wrong place, or we don't need the whole scene. We can drop in halfway through, or we can get out early. But you have to have everything together for that first assembly as it was in the script, unless there's something specific. The director says, yeah, go ahead and lose that now. I know it's not going to make it. But, you know, you need to have one version of that with everything in it in its original form. And that's when you then start working. You would never. Sorry, I'm getting a.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm cheating. That
I'm getting a text. So fine. You would never. It's, you know, it's like you as a writer. You know, you'd never write everything perfect. the first time you're always like, hey, move that sentence up here, this paragraph there, da da da, and something that's in your head you write out and all of a sudden it's a little redundant or quite not clear or whatever it is. And that's the same process you go through with editing, and you're always just trying to tighten,
mm-hmm.
And you know, get it to a place where it's all making sense.
Yeah, the film it's a nonstop roller coaster ride of just,
yeah,
you know, just one thing and so many shocking moments in it, but you don't ever feel like you're leaning on shock value to tell a great story. I want to make people aware of that. This is a kind of a very, you'd think, obvious question, but I understand Tonya Harding was an ice skater. They tell me that.
Margo?
No, I'm not asking. I know she obviously did an enormous amount of preparation, but I was kind of just alluding to the fact that, you know, Tonya Harding is an ice skater, and there's a lot of pretty amazing scenes of ice skating, and I don't know if that was another kind of layer to the work for you, like something.
Definitely. I mean, I think that for me, editorially, it was a really interesting part of the film because there's so many different kinds of scenes in the movie. You know, there are quiet dialogue scenes. There are, fight scenes, arguments.
Mm-hmm.
There are these skating scenes and, you know, much more action and movement and, visual effects with some of that. Margot did quite a lot of her own skating, but then obviously the big professional jumps and spins and, you know, a double did that. It's still actually... We couldn't find somebody to do the triple axel, the big move that,
right,
that
she was so famous for.
Is known for.
Yeah.
There have only been like six women who've done it in the last 25 years, which is amazing.
Incredible.
I think there are only two women right now that can do it that are skating in the Olympics and didn't want to risk injury or whatever. But we couldn't find anybody to actually do the triple axel.
Wow.
So that was a visual effects as well, which is a statement to Tonya Harding and
sure.
How unbelievably good she was as a skater.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the film, you know, we show that real footage of her skating, which to me always breaks my heart because it's at the pinnacle of her career and her joy and excitement in that moment, for that particular performance especially, was just phenomenal. Is particularly heartbreaking after watching the rest of the
Why
film.
Why didn't you just have Tonya Harding do it?
I know. It would be nice, but I'm not sure she could do it these days either. If she could,
yeah,
that would be impressive.
You met her?
I did get to meet her very briefly, yes, at the premiere in Los Angeles last week.
How was that?
It was really fun.
It was
funny.
How did she respond to the, do you know how she responded to seeing the movie?
I think she, for the most part, really likes the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had no real say in the movie. The writer interviewed both Tonya and Jeff Mullooly. The way he came about the whole thing was that he was watching the 30 for 30 documentary, I think it's called The Price of Gold, that about Tonya Harding. And
he
was amazed by the documentary and found Tonya Harding and interviewed her and then found Jeff Galuli and interviewed him. The two of them have not spoken in 25 years.
Really?
All. Still have not spoken.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and their stories were, as the opening card of the film says, wildly contradictory. They didn't agree on much. And that is what he was like, that's the story. That's the way I have to tell this crazy story. Because it's an insane story. A lot of it is completely not believable, and yet it is what happened.
It's insanely entertaining. No,
yes.
It's, I'm not if you have to live through it, but...
It's a wild, wild ride.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how it came about. But so she was interviewed, and this is what she said happened. Her parts of the movie are what she says happened. But other than that, she didn't really have any participation.
No, I would imagine that. I wouldn't imagine that she would. But it's great that she's endorsed it. Given, I mean, I think she comes off, you know, as a real human being. In fact, I'd say the film does a great job of explaining in detail how, you know, she was struggling and that she really wasn't involved in this plan, and that while she obviously could have been more instrumental in terms of helping to write everything, et cetera, but and she had made obviously many bad choices about her relationships, she's a human being. She comes off a lot more sympathetic.
Well, exactly, and I think that's the interesting thing about the story, and for me, any story, I think that, you know, to see the depths of people, to see to see who human beings are. They're never just the one thing, good or bad, that they did. There's all of these layers of people, and this at least informs to the audience something that they never got 25 years ago when they just got this, you know, this first little bit of this 24/7 news cycle where she was pegged right away as being the villain, without much explanation. She was the villain, Nancy was the angel, and that was the way they were playing it, and it stuck for 25 years.
It was a good narrative.
A lot of people have told me they've walked into the movie thinking they're going to watch a movie about this villain, and you know, 10 minutes in, they're like, yeah, wait a minute, maybe it's not quite that clear.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't try to excuse anything. It just informs, I think, for me anyway, it informs why people do, it informs why people do what they do. Whatever their truths are, it lets you know. The interesting thing about this story is that it informs why people do what they do, what their truth is, and what motivates them in their life. There are all of these shades and layers of gray and things that happen that are never shown in the news in these quick little snippets.
It's interesting. We're going through this time now, looking back, 25, 30 years ago, there's been a number of films even further, which kind of has been setting the record straight. I may be generalizing, but I can think of a small number, including the one that I don't know if you saw about Kitty Genovese, made by her brother a couple years ago. I don't know if you saw the Kitty Genovese story. Do you remember that story about the woman in Queens, young woman in Queens who was killed on the street? But there was just like the media has the narrative that becomes something that people will grasp and buy and sell newspapers or create ratings, et cetera. And what I appreciate is this crop of films like I, Tonya, which is setting the record straight, humanizing the people and telling and showing the nuances, the truth of what happened way back when we didn't get the full picture, you know?
Yeah. It's not showing the truth, at least showing the nuances. There's a lot there before we start making our judgments about what happened.
The narrative is more nuanced, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I just want to say in the last thing, because we should wind down. It's time flies when you're having fun. I remember my son, one of the first mature films or, you know, grown-up films. He's 13 now. But his mom and I couldn't connect right away. She had to go to a movie in Brooklyn, and so by the time I got there, I said, "Where's Jacob?" And she goes, "Oh no, I put him in a movie downstairs because this one's too adult." And so he was sitting in the way back.
Oh, great! That's great.
I would not have probably seen, which, by the way, for those listening, Tatiana edited that film as well. And I would not have probably seen it other than the fact I got there probably 10 minutes in, but I sat there and I watched it with him, and he was probably, I mean, how many years ago was it, like four? About four?
I think something like that, 4 years ago.
Roughly,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, so he would have been about nine. You know, he enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a very sweet film. Allison Janney's in that one too.
Oh, that's right, yes. And yeah, but there's a young kid at the heart of it, so it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very nice coming of age story.
Yeah, well, it's been a real pleasure talking
to
you.
Thank you. Me too. This is fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad. And we'll do it again, hopefully in a future project, and maybe in person for all we know.
Great. I would love that. This was really nice. Thank you very, very much.
So, Tanya, still, I guess, in theaters because of all the award season and consideration, right? I assume, right? It's still in theaters. It's still around the country, right?
Yeah, it's in New York and L.A., and it'll be released in other cities rolling out.
Still rolling out.
Early January.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Terrific. All right. Well, thanks again, Tatiana. It was nice meeting you.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
America. They want someone to love. They want someone to hate. I mean, come on. What kind of friggin' person bashes in their friend's knee? Who would do that to a friend?
Stop that.
Thanks, everybody. Once again, have a terrific holiday season. We'll be back with another episode next week because we're like that. We're still going to give you another show next week and keep on going. We have all these wonderful conversations already recorded, so it's just my pleasure to keep things on schedule. So we'll go back to a one-show format starting next week. And please do take care of yourself and the ones you love.
Now here's the real deal. A visit from St. Nicholas. 'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap, I just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below. When to my wandering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them my name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, come Comet on, Cupid on, Donder and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now dash away, dash away, dash away all. And dry leaves that before wild hurricane fly, when they met with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys they had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples how merry, his cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke had encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk and laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. And I heard him explain ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."